Blog Talk Radio.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. Nancy Pfister, heir to Buttermilk Mountain, the world-renowned site of the Winter X Games, was Aspen royalty, its ambassador to the world. She lived among the rich and famous. She partied with Hunter S. Thompson, dated Jack Nicholson, had a joint baby shower with Goldie Hawn, and globetrotted with Angelica Houston. She was also a philanthropist, admired for her generosity. But behind the warm facade, she could be selfish, manipulative, and careless. Pfister enjoyed bragging about her wealth and celebrity connections, but those closest to her, like Kathy Carpenter, Pfister's personal assistant, drinking companion, on one occasion lover, knew better. In 2013, after a long fall from grace, Dr. William Styler and his wife Nancy relocated to Aspen to reinvent themselves. They'd lived the high life before a misguided lawsuit left them near poverty, and Nancy Pfister was their answered prayer. She took them in, gave them a place to live, and allowed them to launch their new spa business. Everything seemed perfect until Pfister turned on them, making increasingly irrational demands and threatening to throw them out on the street. When Nancy was found beaten to death in her own home, the Stylers and Carpenter were all under suspicion for the gruesome murder. But in this close-knit, wealthy town set on keeping its reputation and secret safe from the public eye, the police struggled to solve the mystery of what really happened. The book that we're featuring this evening is Shadow on the Mountain, Nancy Pfister, Dr. William Styler, and the Murder of Aspen's Golden Girl, with my special guests, journalists and authors, Stephen and Joyce Singular. Welcome back to the program, and thank you very much for agreeing to this interview, Joyce and Stephen Singular.
Hi, thank you for having us again.
Thank you very much. Let's jump right into this incredible story, and tell us a little bit. As you know, you're very, very familiar with Colorado and all things Colorado, so let's talk about Aspen, what Aspen is really like, and as you do in the book, you give a little brief history of this interesting place and also where the wealthy play and live and have been for many years. So tell us a little bit about Aspen as you do in the book, Stephen.
Joyce, do you want to?
Well, Aspen is really unique to Colorado. It's on the western slope of Colorado, of the mountains, and it's sort of like the Beverly Hills of Colorado, I guess you could say. It's very, very wealthy. When you go into town, you go by all the private jets that are lined up that take the celebrities and politicians in and out. And it's sort of an insular community. It's there's no place quite like it. And in the 70s, I'll start there, Steve, if you want to jump in earlier than that. But in the 70s, it was like a lot of mountain towns and a lot of resorts, full of a lot of partying and, just a kind of a crazy place. Hunter S. Thompson was living there. He ran for, I think it was mayor of the town. There was a high-profile crime that occurred there in the 70s. Spider Savage, who was on the World Cup circuit ski racer, was living with Claudine Langer, who was married to Andy Williams at one time. And she shot him. She shot Spider Savage and killed him. And a similar thing happened in that case as did with this Pfister case. The case, she got a month, I think, in probation. And the town was quick to close ranks like they did with the Pfister case as well. It was bad for publicity. It was bad for their image. And the whole thing was resolved very quickly and sort of mysteriously. And we were surprised to see that this happened again with this particular case. Steve, do you want to add anything to that?
Aspen was a real boom town back at the end of the 19th century due to the discovery of minerals. It was somewhat wealthy back then, and then all of that went away. The silver market crashed, and Aspen became almost a ghost town with about 300 or 400 people in it in the first part of the 20th century. And then when World War II came, they started training in the mountains up there, and some of the really enterprising people who were involved in that said, we could turn this into a ski resort, you know, if we just had the money. They have three different mountains that are all spectacular for skiing. And eventually those came into being. One of them was Buttermilk Mountain, which does figure into this story. And so that put Aspen on the map as an international ski resort and destination. Then they brought in this music festival in the summer, which brought in musicians and other people from all over the world, very high profile, very prestigious. Then they brought in this Aspen Ideas Festival to bring in, you know, like a think tank for the whole world. They have branches all over the world, as a matter of fact. So that was sort of the foundation for Aspen, and when those things were in place, then it sort of turned into a party town. And Nancy Pfister's mother and father were a part of the generation that really built Aspen, became wealthy as a result of building the ski resort on Buttermilk Mountain, and were, you know, real hardworking, serious folks. That represents sort of the first generation of Aspenites, and then their daughter represents the party time that was just about to erupt, as Joyce talked about, in the late 60s and 70s. And no one represented the old Aspen more than her parents, who were very accomplished people, and no one represented the party more than Nancy.
And in many instances with families like this, the first generation that creates the wealth have a different work ethic than the second generation that, you know, are trust funders, basically, many a time, and don't have the same work ethic. And that's sort of what happened with Nancy Pfister.
And her parents were very aware of this. They had three daughters. The daughters notoriously did not get along, Suzanne, Christina, and Nancy. And it was a open secret that the three daughters did not like each other and quarreled a lot. So when the parents died, or before they died, they set up a system where money was distributed, but not in a very lavish way, especially not for Aspen. And that becomes a real integral part of the story as it unfolds. They didn't want their children to just, you know, blow all this money as quickly as they could, which is something else that a lot of wealthy people do. So that will figure in as this story goes along.
You talk about how Nancy and her sister Suzanne and Christina were raised by parents basically that were more interested in other things rather than parenting. It wasn't their priority. But Nancy grew up differently than Christine and Suzanne, or became a different person. So as we'll say a little bit later in life, what did the other two sisters gravitate towards and become, and what was Nancy left what was Nancy referred to as out of the three, anyway?
Well, the other two were more serious types. I believe one worked for a while in real estate, and another had a jewelry or a collection. Christina made a point of wanting to sort of get away from the family. She said, "I'm the Pfister that, you know, nobody knows." So she eventually moved to Denver and just wanted to completely distance herself, not just from the family, but especially from her sister Nancy. Suzanne lived fairly near Nancy all of her life, but they really did not get along.
Well, Suzanne basically lived across the road from Nancy,
yeah,
and they never really talked.
Yeah. And Nancy was this real outdoor-loving, you know, horseback riding, fishing.
She fancied herself a philanthropist.
Yeah. Yeah.
And she wore many hats. You know, she would portray herself as a producer or someone that worked for the Ellen DeGeneres show. She sort of, sometimes she made up these titles to impress people.
Right. She was very open and friendly, and to a degree that you know, goes beyond what most people would think of those words. There's an anecdote in the book where this guy, this journalist, comes to town, and he's in Aspen. He doesn't really know anybody. He's standing in the middle of town in this mall. It's in the off season. There aren't any people there, and he sees this blonde woman. She was attractive, and he sees her, and he sort of stares at her, and she's eating Chinese food, you know, with chopsticks out of this little box, and she just comes over to him and puts a bite of rice in his mouth. This was like his welcome to Aspen. I mean, that's, you know, not something most people would do. So when people would go around the world, as, you know, Aspen has many world travelers, they would say, you know, we're from Aspen, and the first question would be, do you know Nancy Pfister? Because she behaved that way all over the world.
Right. You talk about all the, in the book, you talk about all the celebrities that she encounters, and the, we mentioned in the introduction about the joint baby shower with Goldie Hawn and globetrotting with all these movie stars. But when we talk about 2012, 2013, and then later 2014, when this story really occurs, you talk about how the luster had gone off her reputation, and things were different for Nancy. So tell us what things had, how things had changed for Nancy Pfister in Aspen.
Well, I'll say this: by now she was getting older. You know, she was in her 50s, late 50s, and many of her friends were of that, of her same age, had already started raising families, you know, several decades earlier, and she didn't. She kind of stayed the party girl a little too long at the party. And so she really was sort of kind of just at loose ends, whereas other people, and she had really had quite a drinking problem by this time too. And so, yeah, a lot of her friends had already moved on, and you can imagine someone that was, you know, the party girl of the 70s, but now it's 2014, and it just didn't really play out that well. And it was sort of, it was kind of sad and tragic, you know. She was sort of a, she had devolved in sort of a tragic figure around town.
Yeah, she would show up places that, we have a story in the book, you know, where the sheriff was making a speech, and she shows up drunk in the famous hotel in Aspen and interrupts him repeatedly and embarrasses him. And it wasn't the first time this happened. You know, she, as Joyce said, she, this drinking problem got more pronounced. And as she aged and as that happened, you know, her friends were no longer these A-list celebrity people, but she was sort of going down the social chain to find people to really hang out with. And that's how she came across and met and got involved with one of the key figures in this case, Kathy Carpenter, who worked at the local Alpine Bank as a teller.
Now tell us about the circumstances that they do meet, because it's very interesting, like you say, this A-lister then now rubbing elbows with this other person. So tell us the circumstances in which they do meet and then strike up a friendship and more.
Go ahead, Steve.
Well, Nancy banked at Alpine Bank, and she went in there. You know, she was always very friendly. She was great at beginnings, let's put it like that. Not so great at middles and endings, but Kathy waited on her, and they struck up a conversation, and Nancy went into the bank quite often and always talked to her, and she said she wanted to be her personal assistant at the bank. And then she called her one day and said, I would like you to work for me. You know, I would like you to be my personal assistant and work with me full-time. And Kathy sort of famously said, you can't afford me, because she had benefits and all of that. So she didn't do that, but they became progressively closer, where Kathy would go up to her house and spend time and drink with her and, you know, watch her dog.
And she kind of afforded, she kind of brought Carpenter into a different social strata.
Right.
Right. And that was appealing to Carpenter.
Yeah, yeah. Kathy was, you know, somewhat insecure, and here she was, you know, hanging out with Aspen royalty, you know, going up to Buttermilk Mountain up
going to parties with her.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, up to her house and hanging out with her. And, you know, some of the time it was fun. On the other hand, they clashed bitterly at times. And that's a part of the story. The police had to come out a couple of times to Nancy's house and separate them and all of that. So she tended to have volatile relationships with both women and men.
Can you explain, as you do in the book, about the situation with the trust fund limits that the parents had imposed so that the daughters wouldn't squander everything, but also how it affected, and in addition to her personality that apparently was, like you say, very good beginnings, but not so once you got to know her. So what did Kathy experience and see in those regards? And tell us about those limits with the money. Or resources?
Well, we were spent a lot of time talking to a private investigator named David Olmsted, who was ultimately working for one of the defendants in the case after this crime. And he told us, again, another great quote for the book, that when the parents, Nancy Pfister's parents, before they had died, they had set it up with a local lawyer named Andy Hecht, who was in the law firm of Garfield and Hecht, that he would control all of the money in their estate and that he would basically dole it out to the sisters on a monthly basis. We were told that she got $7,000 a month. Now, that's not a lot of money in Aspen. And she chafed against this horribly. She didn't think it was enough money to live on. She made a point of going out to dinner with people and maybe saying she would take them out, and then when the bill came, you know, she was nowhere to be seen. So she had major issues around money, and she couldn't really get more money out of that, out of Andy Hecht. So this sets up a conflict right there from the beginning.
Now, you talk about the increasingly the responsibilities that Kathy Carpenter is given by Nancy Pfister, and then Nancy Pfister has an idea to change her life up somewhat, and it's discussed with Kathy Carpenter, and including these new responsibilities or the increasing responsibilities that are given to her. Tell us what she does become. We alluded that she's some sort of assistant, and what's the idea about the rental of the home? Tell us about some of these things that she is responsible for.
As they grew closer, Nancy would take her places on vacation. For example, they went to Hawaii together, but she would have, Nancy liked to go away in the cold weather. So she
had some injuries, some old injuries that, you know, they were achy, and so she would travel to the warm climates in the winter. And you, what you should have said was that Nancy got a dog named Gabe, and then Kathy Carpenter had to start helping watch this dog because Nancy was not very responsible. So, you know, a lot of these things started falling on Kathy Carpenter's shoulders. And I think it was in the fall of 2013 that she had made plans to go to Australia. There was somebody that she was dating there or was interested in, and that's when she had decided to put her house up for rental.
And she was known for making very casual agreements with renters. She didn't like a paper trail or anything like that. She'd just make a verbal agreement, and then she'd say to Kathy, well, you take care of this. You get the money from them. You put the money in my account, and you handle all these transactions because, you know, you're at the bank, and that's where it's done. And so that becomes, you know, a big part of the story that's about to happen.
What we didn't talk about, and I apologize, is that also we should talk about Nancy's daughter, Juliana, and the situation in terms of her parenting. Tell us a little bit about that as we just backtrack a bit, as this will be important later.
Go ahead, George.
Well, as Nancy was getting, you know, as she was getting old, I guess she was probably in her 30s when she had a daughter named Juliana by a Argentinian polo player, and who I think relinquished all rights to Juliana. She basically needed someone to father a child. She decided she wanted a child. But basically, Juliana was brought up mostly by people in the Woody Creek area. Would you say, Steve?
Yeah,
like the Stranahans? And
yeah.
Stranahan is a name that some people might recognize as the liquor people.
Yeah, they make bourbon.
Mm-hmm.
And he's sort of well-known for other things, George Stranahan. But, you know, Nancy's parents, as you already said, Dan, weren't known for parenting, weren't known for their parenting skills. And some people kind of called her a ward of the community. And Juliana was raised very much the same way. Nancy would have a whim. She'd say, I want to fly to France. I want to watch a tennis match in France, or I want to go to Africa and do something. And she would just take off. The child would be left behind with whoever was there to take care of her. That created a lot of conflict between Nancy and her mother. And, again, it was just sort of characteristic of her to do exactly what she wanted to do when she wanted to do it.
Now, you also talk about the relationship, interestingly, and this is important, very, very important later, that you have a former sheriff, if I'm not correct, of Bob Broaddus, and the current one at that time was DeSalvo, Broaddus
right.
was before DeSalvo. So tell us how close a relationship both of these men had, and also the relationship they both had with Nancy Pfister.
Well, it was, there were days, you know, back in the 70s, as Joyce alluded to, when things were much looser in Aspen. There wasn't as much wealth as there is now. There are now 50 of the world's billionaires now live in Aspen, so it's really a bit of a different game. But DeSalvo told us that, you know, back in the days when Hunter Thompson was partying at Owl Creek Farm every night, you know, he could go out there and get in a poker game with him and play and all of that. And that was the world that Nancy was really moving in. I mean, she was a regular at the Hunter Thompson parties where Jack Nicholson would show up or other famous people. She was very close to Broaddus first and then to DeSalvo. She called him Joey, and she called Broaddus, I think, Boo Boo. And she was just, you know, it was a very tight-knit community. They were all, you know, Broaddus was sort of known for, you know, his drug usage before he became the sheriff. And it was a pretty loose environment, and she fit into that perfectly.
And it's pretty, it's not that big of a town, you
yeah.
know. And when winter is over, it gets smaller because everybody descends on it like they do with a lot of ski towns, and it gets, you know, the population grows. But then in the summer, it shrinks again.
Right. And there are only 6,600 people who live there as permanent residents, so it really is small. But there are things in the book that talk about, like, if you're the sheriff of you know, Pitkin County, where Aspen is, you kind of learn to protect rich people's children. And she sort of had that relationship with them. You know, if something, she might have, you know, been drinking and driving or something like that, they might protect her to keep her out of trouble. So the town sort of, you know, closed ranks around her in a way to protect her and her daughter when they were younger. And then that's interesting how that plays out once the crime occurs.
Now, Joyce, can you tell us about Dr. William Styler and his wife, Nancy? And
yes.
Just tell us a little
yeah.
bit about their background.
Okay, well, they both were in the medical profession. I believe Nancy Styler was a nurse at the time, or nurse anesthetist, correct, Steve?
Yep, that's correct.
And that's where she met William Styler, and that was here in Colorado. And he was an anesthesiologist, or he was on his way up, you know, in medical school at the time, you know, going up the ranks. They met. They got married. He eventually became chief of anesthesiology at a big hospital here in Denver named St. Joseph's. And he was very, very successful. And she stopped being a nurse, but she went on to become a prize-winning lily pad cultivator. You know, she'd go to South America, and she cultivated these huge lily pads that they had in their garden that would be so big a small child could actually stand on one of them, you know, and hold its weight. So that became her passion. And he supported her in that. But so they were very well to do. And then eventually he started, what happened is he had an accident. It's kind of unclear because we went through all the medical records we could find, court records, and it's always kind of vague what happened to him. He had some sort of accident, maybe in his backyard. Is that correct, Steve?
Yeah.
Here in southern Denver, which was more like Littleton or Inglewood, which is a suburb south of Denver. And he became incapacitated. He could not do his job as well anymore. And he couldn't stand on his feet. And he just became worse and worse and weaker and weaker. So, he sued the group that he was in. I think they fired him. There was a software company that he helped develop.
Right.
And so there was some kind of conflict about the software that with the anesthesiology group that he belonged to, and they eventually parted ways, and he had to retire early, and his health just started going downhill. Now all the medical bills that they had and other things that happened to him started to lose their wealth. Go ahead and jump in, Steve, if you remember something that I don't.
There's sort of a three-pronged thing. What Joyce said was that, you know, the medical bills hit them, and then he decides to sue this anesthesiology group because he felt they didn't pay him. They actually offered him a pretty good settlement of $135,000. I think it would have been a good idea to take that, but he said, no, I'm going to fight this in court, and I'm going to win. He hires a lawyer who charges him $610,000 to represent him, which everybody felt was a whole lot of money, exorbitant. And then this is occurring around the time of the 2008 crash in the American economy when, you know, they had money invested like so many. And so they were quite well off. I think their house, it's a little detail that sort of factors in, but I think it was like 6,400 square feet with these ponds in the backyard with these lilies that Joyce was talking about. A really beautiful place.
And then he got in an accident, remember? He got in an accident. That didn't help anything because that was even more money that they lost. So they had to sell their house. They had to move out. They had to downsize. They had to go to different locations where they were renting, but, you know, just struggling. And so Nancy Styler decided, who had also had a background as an esthetician, you know, somebody that does Botox and applies false eyelashes and to women, and she had this idea to go up to Aspen and, you know, maybe have like a mobile, like RV type of thing where you could, you know, go and provide these services to the wealthy women up in Aspen, and they could reinvent themselves up there. So they decided to head up to Aspen and look for a place, and that's where they saw the ad in the Aspen Times that Nancy Pfister had put in looking for someone to rent her house, which was a really nice house, and a multi-level house with a greenhouse in the back facing south. And that was really attractive to them, and especially to Nancy Styler, because she wanted, you know, she was an avid gardener. And that's how they met.
She also thought, and it's something Joyce pointed out, that, you know, if women didn't want to be seen getting Botox, you know, in downtown Aspen, this was a few miles out of town, yeah, they might go there and have more privacy for this kind of work getting done. So Nancy Pfister said, yes, move in. You can use my house to start your spa and all these services. And they thought.
And Nancy Pfister, there was talk that maybe she would even invest in their business.
Right.
She started building up. You know, they met, and, you know, she came to the door in her bathrobe with a glass of champagne, and they were kind of taken aback because they're more conservative. And, you know, it was kind of the coming together of two very different types of people. But they were, you know, it looked like everything looked golden about the situation. She looked golden. She was so friendly and nice, and they'd been beaten down. And this just looked like a perfect opportunity. She was going to be gone. They could rent the house for the winter, and they could do their business out of their house. And they just, you know, they jumped on it.
Yeah. And the good times lasted about 2 weeks.
Yeah.
Nancy Pfister was planning on leaving, I think it was like the third week of November. All this happened that Joyce talked about in October of 2013. They saw the ad. They get together. This is their savior. And then they realized in a short order that Nancy Pfister had a drinking problem. and that every day she would, you know, start drinking around noon, or she'd leave the house and go somewhere and drink, and she'd come back and often in a pretty nasty mood. And she started, you know, ordering them around, especially Nancy Styler. And again, you know, here they are. This guy had been the head of anesthesiology in a major metropolitan hospital. Nancy Styler had a big reputation in this area of botany, and they were not, you know, prepared for the kinds of stuff that was coming.
What was their relationship with Kathy Carpenter at that time?
They only got to know her a little bit during that period right there, but then Nancy Pfister did leave. She did have her plans to go away to Australia for 4 to 6 months. She was always a little bit vague on timelines. So what happened was that she told Kathy Carpenter, you know, these people will watch the dog Monday through Friday.
Well, and see, that was news to the Stylers.
Right,
that wasn't part of the deal. So all of a sudden, here's the woman going to Australia. Oh, and by the way, now you're going to take care of my, you know, large standard poodle. So little by little, these things started, you know, grating at them. Oh, now we have to take care of a big dog, you know, and this wasn't part of the agreement.
Right.
So that threw Kathy Carpenter more into the equation now, because maybe if that dog hadn't been involved, then Kathy Carpenter would have just collected the rent every month,
yeah,
and not really had much to do with it. But because of the dog, she was thrown into their life more and more.
And Kathy would come up, and you know, they would have a drink, and they would talk about someone who was gradually, you know, sort of a common enemy. I mean, Kathy had serious conflict with Nancy up to this point. I mean, there's a story in the book where they get into a major fracas in Glenwood Springs, and you know, they almost end up in jail, and they're fighting, and all of those things. So she had her own history, and then the Stylers are gradually understanding this is not, you know, a perfect marriage, and they start complaining, and they're drinking, and Nancy Styler starts doing some work on Kathy, you know, hair and makeup.
Well,
and
mostly eyelashes.
Yeah,
eyelashes,
yeah.
And, like, yeah,
so,
aesthetic things.
Right. So there's, you know, they're thrown together, and they start talking about all sorts of things.
Commiserating.
Yeah.
Truly.
So the Stylers, I mean, they really did not have much money at all. I mean, they were virtually broke by this time.
Well, and what was the rent that they were paying every month? I mean,
well,
it was significant.
$6,000. They needed,
yeah,
$6,000 to come to sort of move in, and then they were going to pay $6,000 more. That was in November, like at the end of December. And so then one of the first things that happened was that the water system broke down in the house, and Pfister got all upset about that. But that meant Nancy Styler couldn't start her spa business, and just one thing after another sort of started to go wrong. So where the story gets more intriguing is that they did manage to come up with the $6,000, and then they managed to come up with another $6,000. And they gave it to Kathy Carpenter, again, who worked at the bank and who had sort of a safety deposit box for Nancy Pfister. And Nancy Pfister started to blow up because she didn't get that $6,000. So this is the first, like, major crack in the relationship. So the question becomes right there, you know, where did that $6,000 go? You have somebody in Australia demanding the money. You have somebody in Aspen saying they paid the money. And you have somebody at the local bank in the middle of all that. So then Nancy Pfister turned really nasty on them. Very quickly, it all degenerated. She said, you need to move out. I need to find other renters. And it starts to unwind from there.
You talk about that it's instead of the 6 months, she's going to cut her vacation short and come back and deal with this, which seems to a lot of people later and maybe even at the time is sort of an overreaction to this. So what does Kathy Carpenter in preparation for that, and what do the Stylers do in response to this being tossed out, even though they've spent the money? What do they do in response to this?
Well, they try to communicate with her lawyer. She had a lawyer there named John Beatty, and they were just in a state of shock. I mean, they were like, we just moved in November. We did everything she
and
asked.
And they didn't know what they were going to do.
I mean,
they were desperate.
Correct. Yeah. And so, you know, first of all, Dr. Styler sort of blows up at the lawyer, blows up at Nancy Pfister. Then he, you know, backs off and says, you know, let's work this out. You know, we gave you the money. We've kept our agreement. And, you know, let's see if we can work through this. Nancy Pfister just, she was, once she turned on you, I mean, she was very nasty. And so, again, and that, whatever Kathy Carpenter was doing or had done, she basically kept to herself. So, it just more or less arbitrarily, it's the middle of February now. She's only been gone 3 months. And she says, I'm coming home. I'm going to fly home on February 22nd, get those people out of there. They have to be gone when I get back, and they have to have their stuff out of my place. And, Joyce, do you remember, like, the things they had in there? I mean, it was a lot of major.
Oh, they had thousands of dollars worth of, you know, her special facial laser machines,
right,
and things that she had bought. I mean, worth, I think, hundreds of thousands of dollars that they had invested for this startup business that they were going
to. They had to bring it all up from Denver. They had to move it into the house. They had to try to set up their business. You know, and these people are in their mid-60s. I mean, they were not young people, and they had fallen a long way from grace. They were in a state of shock, but they realized that they needed to get out, that this was a serious situation, and Nancy Pfister was in fact on a plane coming back.
And it was unfortunate that Nancy Pfister kept playing sort of a cat and mouse type of game with them. I mean, she started pushing them and calling them names, and, you know, like you belong in a trailer court down the road, and just really saying these ugly things to attack their ego. And it's sort of like, to me, I always looked at it like a cautionary tale. You don't know when you're in traffic if the person that's cutting you off, you know, you shouldn't say something to them or make some sort of, you know, gesture at them, because you just never know who you're up against in a situation like that. And that's sort of what happened here. The Stylers didn't really know who she was. And they didn't know, and Pfister didn't know who they were. And William Styler also had a very bad temper.
Right.
So you have these two people with really bad tempers. And it was a perfect storm coming together of strangers that cross each other's paths that, you know, ended up in murder.
And as to go back to the earlier part of the story, Nancy Pfister really needed that $6,000 in money. I mean, she was always talking about how wealthy she was and how wealthy her family was. It absolutely wasn't true. So when that $6,000 doesn't show up at the end of December, early January, it really threw her over the edge, because she needed all the money she could get her hands on. So, as Joy said, neither, you know, they fell in love real quickly with each other, and they had no idea who they were dealing with. She didn't understand that the Stylers had spent about a decade just losing all of their money, all of their prestige, and their home. So it was a volatile situation.
Now tell us about the 2 days or 3 days in question here, the third week of February here. And what happens regarding these players, the Stylers and Kathy Carpenter, and then what was going on in terms of, you write in the book that there was something else going on that might have precipitated Nancy coming back from Australia. So another reason other than just to kick somebody out of this rental. So tell us a little bit about that.
Well, again, money sort of being the underlying issue of a lot of things here. What nobody could understand was why Nancy Pfister would drop everything, fly back from Australia, And, you know, to kick these people out, as the number of people told us, it costs as much to come back and do all that as just to have her lawyer evict them, which would have been a much cleaner thing. So, as I said earlier, we talked to this private investigator who ultimately would be representing Nancy Styler after her arrest, and he said that what nobody's talking about is that there was a land sale planned right around that time from the Buttermilk Mountain estate. Every now and then they would raise money by selling off a piece of that of those properties, and it was not a small amount of money. So the story, the narrative of this murder really starts on February 22nd, and we'll talk about more what happens in between, but Nancy Pfister is found dead on February 26th, 4 days later, and 2 days after that, this massive sale of land goes through for $4.5 million. None of that money was going to go to Nancy Pfister, and there was speculation that she was upset about that, that she wanted to be involved in that, and that that may have been another motivation for coming home. Again, it implies conflict with her sisters over the sale of the land, over the money, and all of those issues were in play. Also, generally speaking, when somebody's a part of a real estate transaction like that and they get murdered, you wouldn't carry out the sale 2 days later. But in this particular case, it was carried out. All the money transactions went through. And so this raised all kinds of questions about, was she really coming back over a dispute over a few thousand dollars in rent, or was she coming back over millions and millions of dollars in this land sale?
Now, you talk about that, of course, that Kathy Carpenter makes this 911 call, but first, there is Nancy's just missing from people on the, I think, the Tuesday. So take us back to those days and some of the people that are noticing that she's not around, people that would normally speak to her, interact with her. Tell us what happens.
Okay, so she flies back on the evening of the 22nd, which is a Saturday, and she insists that Kathy Carpenter spend the night with her. And then Sunday comes. Kathy was actually in AA, in Alcoholics Anonymous. She goes to a meeting, and her advisor there says, you know, there's something really off with this woman.
Let me just preface this by saying very quickly, and then please continue, Steve, that by this time, Nancy Styler is going around town and saying in public, boy, I really wish that someone would just kill that Nancy Pfister, you know. I mean, coming out and saying that blatant of a thing, okay?
Yeah, right. No, that's
okay, that's important.
She had said this to several people. She effectively said, you know, she'd be, you know, better off dead.
And William Styler was, like, going to the local jewelry store to try to pawn Nancy Styler, his wife's wedding ring and wedding bands. They were desperate for money.
Yeah.
And he said to the man as he was leaving, well, because the man said, I can't give you very much for this. Well, I guess I should just kill myself then.
Right. And to go back to what Joyce said about sort of a cat and mouse game, so that was Saturday night. On Sunday, Nancy Pfister's back at her home with Kathy, and she writes down on a piece of paper that Kathy is going to meet William Styler later in the day. They're going to exchange cars. And Kathy has to tell him that he owes Nancy Pfister $14,000.
And they were exchanging cars because Kathy had a bigger car. Station wagon, right? And they were going to borrow her car to start moving things out of the house.
Here they are, you know, trying to accommodate, trying to get out of that house as quickly as possible. Not an easy thing to do. Middle of winter. And they're moving their stuff out, and then Kathy meets them and hands the piece of paper and says, you owe her $14,000, and she's not going to release your equipment back to you until you give her that money. They were virtually broke.
The equipment that was worth over $100,000.
Yeah. So this was a profound, you know, slap in the face to them. And, of course, Dr. Styler said, you know, he blew up. I'm not going to give her a penny, blah, blah, blah. He went back and he told his wife, they were staying in a cheap motel in Basalt, which is about 20 miles down the road from Aspen. And, of course, she blew up, causing her to say some of the things she did. But Dr. Styler talked about, you know, fighting off depression for a long time during all their troubles. But now the story kind of turned, and he said, my wife was depressed, and I didn't want her to, you know, suffer anymore. And that becomes important with the story that he tells. So that's Sunday. Monday comes, and at 8:30 in the morning, he was going to get a van so they could continue their moving out. But he goes, and the van place is not open until 10 or 10:30. So he does something else. Now, as far as we know, I mean, that's all we know for a long time. In other words, they're trying to move out. He's trying to get a van. His wife is at the motel. So they can't do too much moving that day. They eventually go back to the house, and Nancy Pfister is nowhere around. They can't find her. They call her name. She's nowhere about. So they think she just took off again because that was sort of what she did. So they move as much as they can on Monday. They move as much as they can on Tuesday. They go back to the house. They can't find her. They don't know where she is. And then Wednesday comes, and again, the exact same pattern. She's not in the house. The dog is there. The dog's bowl is empty. There's some messes around the house, but she's nowhere to be seen. So they leave. They're officially moved out now by midday Wednesday, which is the 26th. And Nancy Styler contacts Kathy, and Kathy's going to go up to the house, and she's going to do whatever she does up there. I think take care of the dog at that point, because the dog needs some attention. So she goes to the house, and she
goes up
around.
And goes up the stairs. She goes up the stairs to where Nancy's bedroom is.
Right.
Because you have to go up a couple of flights of stairs.
Which, again, is very important.
Yeah. And wasn't there a note on the door, too, that said, oh, please don't bother me, I'm sleeping.
Right.
You know, signed Nancy Pfister. And she had she had jet lag. She'd come back from Australia, and she was known to take quite a cocktail of medications along with her, you know, her usual Prosecco or champagne to wash it down with. So everybody just assumed she was out cold, sleeping. Okay,
yeah,
go ahead.
But she's not in the bed. And Kathy Carpenter goes in the room, and she looks around the bedroom, and the bed is made, and that's like the first light that goes off in her. She said, Nancy Pfister never made a bed in her life. Other people made the bed for her. So something here doesn't quite add up. She looks around. There's no Nancy Pfister. She looks at the headboard on the bed, and she sees something that could be blood. She's not quite sure. But she looks around, she goes to the closet in the bedroom, and she doesn't have the key. She had put the key in the door the last time she was there, Sunday or Monday, and the key's gone. And that's like the second thing that's really abnormal. So she has to drive back downtown to Aspen, get the second key, and come back. And she opens that closet door, and she sees this bundle of something in the closet. There are blankets, there's plastic material, there's something wrapped inside of all of this material. And so she totally freaks out. It's very debatable what she saw when she looked in the closet. This is a big part of the story. And it's also debatable what she saw on that headboard. She goes halfway down the mountain.
Well, she said she saw hair, right?
She said she either saw a headboard with blood on it or a forehead with blood on it. And the 911 call that she then makes is somewhat confusing because if she saw the woman's forehead or her blonde hair wrapped in all that stuff, that was physically impossible. The body was entirely covered up, and she would have had to have seen the body before it went into that wrapping.
Or she could have unwrapped it and looked
or
in. Why didn't she just say, I looked under, but she never said that.
So,
she never said, I uncovered what was under the plastic bags, you know, and saw the, she was adamant that she just looked in and saw this hair. So this is pivotal.
Right. So it doesn't, you know, there are inconsistencies at best in her story. She goes down the mountain, calls 911. One of the officers shows up and notes that she's been drinking. Now, she was, as you recall, in AA 2 or 3 days earlier. Apparently, she had had something to drink. That might have confused her. So she goes basically to the police station that night and tells them about all the conflict between Nancy Pfister and the Stylers. And at about 5 o'clock the next morning, there's a knock on the door at the motel room in Basalt, and the police take the Stylers into custody. And they are apparently totally in shock at that point.
You talk about that they take the direction from Kathy Carpenter and look at the Stylers and start investigating. But you have a very, very interesting character, an investigator, a private eye named, you mentioned before, David Olmsted, that comes in once they are charged. How does Kathy Carpenter become to be one of the three charged in this?
Well, the Stylers are quickly taken into custody, and they don't implicate Kathy Carpenter. But the transcription, as I recall, of the 911 call does refer to Kathy Carpenter talking about the forehead. So if that happened, then her story doesn't hold up. It just doesn't make sense. There's another contradiction in her story as well. She tells the police that night when she drove up to Pfister's house the first time, she saw the Stylers leaving. That was not the truth. The Stylers, Joyce, do you remember where Nancy Styler was at that time? She was in Glenwood Springs getting an eyelash extension.
Yeah.
So it's another real basic inconsistency. So they grilled her for about 20 or 22 hours straight, two detectives in particular, and ultimately, you know, felt that her comment about the blood, seeing the blood, was enough of an inconsistency to arrest her. So by the middle of March, which is about 2 weeks, to a little more than that, after the body is found, you now have three people in custody, Dr. Nancy Stylar and Kathy Carpenter, and they're going to be charged not only with first-degree murder, but with conspiracy, you know, to commit this murder, meaning that somehow all of them came together, planned this thing, and carried it out to get rid of Nancy Pfister. This case, when you look at it on the surface, and this is something I was really struck by, seems rather simple. The more you know about it, the more complex it becomes.
Yes. I mentioned David Olmsted and his ideas that were met with resistance from the lawyers that he was supposed to be working with, ideally. And you talk about also the idea or the issue of Mr. Stryker, Stylar's health. What did he find, and what was basically the issue that was at hand regarding his health?
Well, he was not able to do a lot of physical things. You know, he was, you know, somebody had said that they saw him at the post office, and he was barely able to, you know, to walk or to lift, or several people around town had said that he looked in very bad shape. And Nancy Stylar, his wife, was robust, and she did all the heavy lifting, and she was the one that was really, you know, taking care of the two of them, at least physically.
Right. He would talk about, you know, barely being able to move around at all. So there were two different staircases in the Pfister house that you would have to negotiate, you know, into the house and up to the bedroom to go there and kill somebody if you're doing that. Then you would have to turn over the mattress. It turns out that the mattress had been flipped over and there was blood under it. And then you would have to figure out how to wrap a body. All people in law enforcement say that dead bodies, you know, feel heavier than any live body. So it's very hard to move them and to wrap them up and to do all those things. And from the beginning, the idea was there's no way in the world Dr. Styler could have done this or at least done it by himself. So that was part of the belief system, that there had to be at least two or three people involved here in carrying out the crime.
We also didn't mention the condition of the body of Nancy Pfister. Tell us about that.
Well, she had numerous head wounds. She had been struck by a hammer several times in the head. And so, yeah, she was not in good shape when they found her. I mean, she was pretty badly mutilated.
Yeah, she was beaten to death. That was the cause of death. So, again, there was this general belief that this 65-year-old incapacitated man could never have done this kind of thing on his own.
Now, in the investigation, of course, they execute search warrants, and again, as you mentioned, it looks like a very simple case, except as the further you go into this, you have more and more questions and doubts, and serious doubts at that. Tell us about what the police find, and is very interestingly how incriminating some of this evidence is. Tell us about what they find incriminating the Stylers, and especially Mr. Styler.
I believe it was on Friday, the 28th of February. So the body's found on the 26th. The Stylers are taken into custody the next day. And on the 28th, there's a municipal worker in Basalt, again, about 20 miles from Aspen, where the Stylers are staying. And it's his job to pick up the trash from these dumpsters at the end of the week. So he doesn't like it if people put, you know, sort of personal items in there. He finds a bag in there, a plastic trash bag, and he opens it, and he's been reading about the case of Nancy Pfister, who was just found murdered in Aspen, and some of her things identifying her are in
jewelry.
That bag. Well, things with her name on it, medicine bottles,
mm-hmm.
things. And then there's a hammer in there with what appear to be blood flakes on it, and a car registration for Dr. Styler. And in addition to that, as I said earlier, when Kathy Carpenter goes to open the closet the first time, there's no key in there. 20 feet from the Styler's
hotel room, yeah.
The key is found. So
in plain view, almost.
Yeah. So, again, it kind of raises the question. Here, the Stylers have been very bright people all their lives, successful for the most part. Why would you leave a key identifying you with a murder 20 feet from your motel room?
Or was it planted by someone?
Was it planted?
Mm-hmm.
Kathy Carpenter had a therapist who worked in Basalt, and she would go over there, and so it raised questions. Did she put some of this evidence there?
Mm-hmm. You also talk about, and we won't have enough time to go into all of this, twists and turns that happen in this, but a surprise happens 8 days before the preliminary regarding Nancy Styler. What happens and why?
Well, the question was, like, when Joyce and I went up for some of the early hearings in this very small Aspen courtroom, because they don't, you know, they
the same one that Ted Bundy jumped out the second floor window
right.
to escape, you know, years earlier when he was on the run.
Right. And so you had you know, you had three defendants, all of their lawyers, and several prosecutors, and you were trying to fit all of this jigsaw puzzle together. If there's a conspiracy, who did what, who planned it, and all of that. And you really, nobody had any idea what actually happened in this crime. And so the preliminary hearing was set for, I think, June 16th. And we were all waiting, you know, well, the prosecution's going to present their case. We'll find out what happened. And on June 9th, they were actually going to hold this hearing. But one of the key detectives in the case wanted to go on vacation, so they postponed it. If that hearing had come off, the whole case probably would have turned out differently. But for some reason, 7 days later, Dr. Styler decides to call the authorities and say, these two women had nothing to do with this. I did it all on my own, and they're totally innocent, and I'm totally guilty. So the question immediately becomes, they were all in custody and in jail now for about 100 days. So was he actually telling the truth, or was he just trying to get his wife out of jail? Because as Joyce said earlier, he had been talking about suicide. His health was apparently failing. What was his motive?
It's very interesting what David Olmsted has to say, or some of the questions that he has. What is his take on a lot of this?
Well, the really intriguing part of it, as crime writers, as forensic, you know, people who are so interested in forensics and evidence and all of that sort of thing, is that the story that Dr. Styler will now tell the police at great length is that, yes, he got up on that Monday morning, February 24th. He went to pick up the truck. The place was closed, so he decided to drive up to Nancy Pfister's home and confront her about the $14,000 that she had asked for them from them the day earlier. He gets up there. The door is open, which again, some people thought it was locked. And he goes into the house and he calls her name and he doesn't get an answer. And this is his story, and he goes up the stairs, into the house, he goes up the stairs to the bedroom, he finds her sleeping. As Joyce said earlier, she was known to take pills and drink, so she slept soundly. He sees her sleeping, and he just sort of has one of these absolutely cathartic moments. He just says, I can end all my problems right here. He goes down the stairs, and again, think about what we've been saying. This was a guy who couldn't hardly walk.
And was in a wheelchair at all of the hearings.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And who was seen crawling across his cell on his hands and knees to emphasize to his jailers that he couldn't walk. So he goes, he remembers it from living in the house that there's a hammer there. So he goes down and he gets the hammer and he stands over her and he looks and he just apparently loses it, starts, you know, bashing her head in, and
since he was a doctor, he knew exactly what part of the head to hit.
Exactly. Then, you know, she's bleeding, right? So, what are you going to do now? So he pulls the blanket off the bed with her on it. Then he needs to figure out a way to tie her up. So he goes down the stairs again. He gets some cord and some things that he can wrap her in. Then he needs bags to cover up the body, and so then he goes back down again. So there are at least 3 to 4 trips to do this, in addition to being strong enough to beat her to death, in addition to getting her off the bed.
Flipping the mattress, yeah.
All of those things, and getting her into the closet with no blood on the floor or anything like that. So this is the story that he tells. And there's only one or two major problems with it, and that is that several people would then tell the authorities as they were interviewed that they received messages from Nancy Pfister from a time perspective well after the story that Dr. Styler tells about killing.
Or that Nancy Styler's cell phone pinged off of a tower close to Nancy Pfister's house about the same time that William Styler was up there committing the crime.
Exactly. Right. So, which implies, of course, that his wife was there with him, helping him. So there are major inconsistencies in the timeline from what we were able to assemble in writing the book. And what becomes important about all of that is that the legal system heard Dr. Styler's story, didn't care one whit for the contradictions or the inconsistencies, and said, okay, we got our man, case closed, they turned the women loose, that was that. They just, like Joyce said earlier about the Claudine Longet case, they could not wait to have this done and to put it behind them. And whatever the truth was would just have to take care of itself.
I know the answer, but tell us why that is so important to the media and to the town of Aspen itself. Why is it that they had to control this narrative, and why did they want this watered down, easy to swallow explanation?
Well, part of it was because if it had gone to trial, a lot of Nancy Pfister's dirty laundry would have been aired, you know, and the Pfister family was quite prominent, and all these land sales and her behavior, and a lot of these things would have come out in court, and it would have not have been comfortable for the family, the remaining family, or for her daughter, or for her sisters, or for others in town, you know, and this is where there's more questions than answers. This land, these land dealings, these real estate sales, all these things, these are still ongoing now, right now. There's still lawsuits going on. There's much more to this story than that. It didn't end with him, you know, saying that he committed the crime by himself. The story continues.
Right. And that last hearing where he stands up and confesses and said, I did it, is occurring right at the most, probably the most prominent moment for Aspen, which is the Aspen Food and Wine Festival that occurs like on the first day of spring.
And then numerous other festivals happening all summer long are now going to start up, you know.
And so you have all these prominent, you know, rich people coming in, and then you have this very ugly murder sitting right next to it. And we interviewed the sheriff about it, and it was the most famous line in the book, maybe. We asked him, well, you know, do you really think this happened, or, you know, how do you think it happened? And he said, Dr. Styler confessed, and it works for me.
But, yeah. You know, I'd like to say that after, there's so much more to the story, and I wish we could tell, you know, just we could talk for hours about it, but we're going up to Aspen next week because CNBC has decided to make an hour-long doc about it, and hopefully they'll cover some of the information that was not covered in the Dateline or the different, you know, all three major networks did shows on this crime. It was so interesting. And hopefully CNBC will do something more and kind of dig a little bit deeper into some of the things that have happened since the death of William Styler.
Yeah, so what happened was that the women were released, and Dr. Styler had $1 million insurance policy on himself for his wife, and about a year after the case was resolved. He was in prison in Colorado. He hung himself in his cell and died, and the money went to Nancy Styler. So, again, it raises all these questions. Did he plan all of this out, you know, take the fall for the crime, then kill himself, then give the money to his wife? All he talked about during his confession, or what he mainly talked about, was finding a way to relieve his wife's stress. And was this his plan all along to be able to do that?
Yeah. It's definitely a compelling argument for certain. I want to thank you very much, Stephen and Joyce Singular, for coming on and talking about Shadow on the Mountain. For those that might want to take a look at other work, give a website, Facebook page, any of that for contact.
Yeah, go ahead, Joyce.
www.stevensingular.com. Stephen with a PH is, we always update that as to what appearances and television shows and any kind of breaking news with, you know, what's going on with in our world. We always update that. So, yeah, please come and give our website a look, and You can see all the other books and things that we've been involved with.
And yeah. Best of luck, too, as well with the upcoming documentary, and so hope to see that in the future. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Again,
thanks for having us.
Thank you. It's always a pleasure. Joyce and Stephen Singular, you have a great evening. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Good night.